The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Living Well into the Future with your host, Julie B. Adler, where we introduce you to guests of all generations whose lived experience and expertise informs and stimulates us toward discussions and actions that foster living well ourselves and in our communities. You can listen to past episodes through the WTBRFM.com website and wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us and continue to write to us to let us know if their content gave rise to discussions or actions on your part. Let us know which episodes were relevant to your life, what you want to hear more about. You can reach us through our website, livingwellintothefuture.net, where you can get more information about our guests, show notes, and information about past episodes. Write to us at lwitf22@gmail.com. Let us know what you think of the topic, our guests, and what you would like to hear more about.
Thank you. I'm your host, Julie B. Adler. In this episode, we explore how music builds and unites communities and individuals. Our guests are three musicians, ranging in age from their early 30s to their early 50s. Each is in a different stage in their career, but all three contribute to the health and vitality of their local communities, as well as the national and worldwide communities of music makers, of which each is a part. In this episode with Ryan LaBoy and Daniel Anastasio, we talk about building communities of music lovers and strengthening ties through music within and across communities. In our next episode, we turn our attention to the power of music to heal with Ryan and Daniel, joined by Dr. Penny Roberts, a distinguished music therapist with over two decades of experience and degrees in piano pedagogy, music therapy, and aging. Now to introduce you to our first guest. Ryan Jose LaBoy is a singer, conductor, and community musician based in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, where he serves as artistic director of the Berkshire Children's Chorus and Berkshire Concert Choir. Ryan holds degrees in choral conducting and music education from the University of Minnesota and Westminster Choir College. He is currently a doctoral student at Teachers College, Columbia University, with research interests located at the intersection of community arts and public health. His scholarly pursuits include practices of community music, the advent of social prescribing in Massachusetts and the United States, and the transformative power of singing together. Welcome, Ryan LaBoy, to Living Well into the Future.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Ryan, you've been involved in choruses as a singer, music director, conductor in a variety of settings, including at a community college in Minnesota and now in the Berkshires in Massachusetts. How do you program music that both the singers and the audiences connect to?
I think one of my strengths as a conductor and an artistic director, regardless of what context I find myself in, is the desire to make stronger community connections using my platform as a means of amplification, or using my position as like a clearinghouse for community connectedness. My first semester in a new position, I feel like really that project ought to be your sort of welcome letter to the ensemble, right? Like that project really is about you. And that's you letting the ensemble know what your aesthetic values are, what your social values are. Then throughout that project, as you're preparing, you just take notes on what are the other interests of the people in the room and where are they coming from. In the case of the community college, what schools are they coming from? What high schools or other schools are they coming from? And how proximate are they to this physical space? And how can we start to make connections with those institutions? And so that really was how I caught stride at the community college. In Minnesota, high school students are allowed to take college courses, community college courses for credit for free. So that also helped to strengthen my tie to the area high schools. And so then really, I was getting to know the values of the community, not just through the students in my choir immediately, but through the local high school programs, and would just pick music in collaboration with their directors or music that I thought reflected or amplified their values in some way.
Can you give examples of what that might be in choral music?
Yeah. Well, at the community college, I remember one particular project we did. We called it the Campus Lounge Tour because even though we were performing ensemble at the college, much of the college didn't know we existed. One of the paradoxes is that we were known a little bit better out in the community beyond the college, but within the college itself, people didn't know who we were. Part of my mission then became to more deeply connect us to our home institution. So the voice can travel. You can take the voice anywhere. And so I coordinated with Student Life to give a series of pop-up performances around campus in these various campus lounges. And the program was called The Birds and the Bees. These students range in age from 18 as a PSEO student coming from high school into the ensemble to 40, right? So it may be impossible to program a single piece that is for everyone. But by and large, most of these students are between ages 18 and 22, like your typical college age student. At that point, you're getting your first taste of independence. You have lots of big feelings. And music history is just rich with illustrative examples of love, requited and unrequited, and lost and gained. And I programmed this concert that was all about birds and bees from across the eras. And so we end up singing Il Bianco e Dolce Cigno, which is a Renaissance madrigal about a swan. And we end up singing a song by Wolfpack, which was a contemporary band called Back Pocket that talks about being in fifth grade and being in love and passing notes. And so it's making these connections across eras. We sing this beautiful Spanish language song called Te Amo, which is just this very lush and rich love song. And so all of a sudden, we're weaving together this tapestry of love from across eras and different cultures that I think students at that age, again, your first taste of independence and your first like grappling with big feelings beyond the safety of your family and immediate community. I think students really took to that. And then we just took it around campus and people responded to it really well. They loved it.
Oh, great examples. Before you were music director at the community college, you were founding music director of Communication, an El Sistema-inspired choral youth development program. Who were the participants? How did music enter into it?
Yeah, so Communication was a really important piece of my early career as a conductor, both during my master's program and beyond. I was the founding music director, the founder proper. Her name is Zara Zanussi, and she did this El Sistema fellowship in Boston before coming home to the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul. And then once she got there, she started doing some community connection and realized that she needed a music director. And so I was brought on at that point. We worked directly in an area of St. Paul called Frogtown. And what is interesting about Frogtown is that Minnesota as a state is known for being pretty white, right? Like that it just is a truism. But diversity exists there in the same way that diversity exists everywhere. And Frogtown is a really powerful example of the harm that has been done to the Black community, particularly in America. The Twin Cities have a history of redlining, like a really concerted attempt to divide Black community. And Frogtown is an example of that when it was this thriving middle-class Black community in St. Paul, Minnesota, early in the 20th century, and when the state developed the highway system, the highway they built to pass immediately through this town. So then essentially, Frogtown was divided on either side of the highway, and that middle class thriving community crumbled throughout the 20th century.
Listeners to Living Well into the Future would have heard of other occurrences like that throughout the country, especially in our Resilience Justice Program. when Tony Arnold and his students spoke about just that circumstance?
We founded Communication around 2013. As a means of being musically responsive to this community. Everybody deserves a high quality arts experience, whether or not they have the means or resource to pay for it. And so Communication was working with young people from that neighborhood, primarily elementary age students, bridging into middle school, because within youth development work, there's a lot of gaps, particularly at the middle school level. But when you're starting an organization, you have to build from the ground up. So it's really hard to walk into a community and say, we're going to start doing something for seventh graders, because seventh graders are just naturally very suspect of anything that you bring their way. So you start with your third and your fourth graders and you grow with them. And so that's what we did with Communication in the El Sistema model. El Sistema is not a pedagogy per se, it's a philosophy, it's a framing of programming. And part of El Sistema, practically speaking, is high frequency and high intensity rehearsals throughout the week. So we would see these kids three times a week for 90 minutes at a time. That's very intensive for kids of this age. You're talking about like 9-year-olds. During that time, of course, it wasn't all singing in ensemble all the time. Part of it has to be, you got to feed the kids, right? Because they're coming from after school. And we partnered with, ultimately, our long-term partner ended up being the Boys and Girls Club in Frogtown. And so we partnered with the Boys and Girls Club to help meet those needs. Kids could take the bus from their school to the community center. So transportation and food were folded into our work so that everybody was able to get there safely, everybody's belly was full, and then we could make music together. And all in all, I think the kids would come for like a 2.5 to 3 hour block of time after school, but 90 minutes of that was dedicated choral rehearsal. And that led to just some really fantastic musical and social opportunities. When you have that much time to work with a group of singers, irrespective of age, you have the gift of getting beyond the notes, right? And just like learning for performance. And so we were able to break ideas apart, like harmony and dissonance, right? What does it mean when two notes butt up against each other? And what does it mean when that tension resolves? And how do we see that playing out in our lives? Where are moments that you experience dissonance? And how does that resolve? And what happens if it doesn't resolve? In music, there's plenty of examples of where tension doesn't resolve. And that conjures a really evocative example for us. Where is there tension in your life that's not resolved? And you may be sitting there thinking, this is a big conversation to have with a 9 or a 10-year-old, but they have so much to say. in their limited years, they have so much to say if you phrase the question the right way and then just give them the space to grapple with it and really think through it. They're not going to have quick and immediate answers like you and I might have. It might take them a little bit longer. But so musically speaking, that's one way. And then one of the great gifts of vocal music is that we have text and we have poetry. And so we can ask ourselves, when we sing Langston Hughes' Dreamkeeper, give me all of your dreams, you dreamers, give me all of your heart melodies, that I may wrap them in a blue cloud cloth away from the two rough fingers of the world. What the heck does that mean? But what a fabulous question to unpack with kids. And right now, actually, the reason I know that text so immediately is because we're singing that with the Berkshire Children's Chorus right now. But I first learned that in my work with Communication. And then that leads to questions of, what are your dreams for within the Sistema philosophy? The founder of Sistema, Maestro Abreu, would say that the worst impact of poverty is not the lack of food or resource, it is the feeling of invisibility and that you don't matter, right? And how can we, through our singing, through our making of music, offer people sight? How can we witness their existence and nurture their being? And how can we amplify their voice, both literally and metaphorically, so that they're not feeling that devastating impact? And that in this community, what I learned really quickly coming from my conservatory and liberal arts background, this was a real sharp contrast, is kids in that context don't get to dream. Dreaming is, I don't even know if that's on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but dreaming would be pretty close to the top, right? You don't really have the privilege of thinking more than a week or a month or maybe a couple months beyond where you are right now. And that includes our kids' parents. So creating a space where we could give our kids the space and time to think about what is a dream and what is a dream that I might have. And then to invite their parents into that conversation. It was really profound work that we were doing.
Is that effort ongoing?
Yeah, communication is still around. I stepped away from it when I moved to North Hennepin Community College, and now I think it's in year 11, which is great.
And how is it funded?
Oh, Minnesota is great in terms of providing arts funding through various state arts grants. You have to cultivate individual donors as well. And we have key partners. At least at the time that I was there, we partnered pretty regularly with Minnesota Orchestra, for example. So the orchestra might not be writing us a paycheck, but the orchestra is offering us a network through which we can foster those relationships that lead to a meaningful contribution to the organization.
I have seen examples of Dudamel working with El Sistema, and I saw the Pittsfield Orchestra on the streets of Pittsfield having used that method. And I find it a marvel having struggled with the viola from the third grade. But how does it work with voice in terms of developing the skill?
Oh, if you've seen the Disney movie Ratatouille, the catch line is anyone can cook. It's my deep belief that anyone can sing. And like how polished and perfect that is another question. And is perfection even a noble pursuit? So you just need to get rid of the varnish and just let the voice go. Sure, there are people who struggle to match pitch, or although I think that tone deafness is truly rare. Mostly it's like a coordination thing that your ear hears one thing, but the muscles that make up the voice can't quite coordinate, right? And that's something that can be resolved with time. So yeah, I do care deeply about singing being beautiful, but I don't care about beauty at the expense of human value and dignity. For example, if I catch myself with either my children's ensembles or my adult ensembles, and this is deeply ingrained in me because I went to a conservatory, I went to Westminster Choir College, and I will forever be grateful for that education. It really gave me so much. And also, it means that my ears have very specific expectations of what good choral music is. And I catch myself in rehearsal sometimes in that dogged pursuit of that very specific sense of beauty. And if ever I am able to, in the moment, sense that I am pursuing that at the expense of the people in the room having a positive experience in the here and now, in that day, in rehearsal, I pause, I step back, I say, let's go to a different piece. Because it's not worth it. That's not what it ultimately is about. That's not what the world needs of choral music right now. Maybe at a different time that worked, but right now in our society, that is not what we need. In reference to Sistema and Kids for Harmony playing in the street, I think one of the really powerful opportunities Sistema offers us is what we would call informances or frequent community performances or informal performances, saying, hey kids, it doesn't matter if this is fully baked, right? We will continue singing or playing this piece for months and months and months. But now that we have it memorized, let's challenge ourselves to just learn it quickly and get it memorized, right? And we can refine throughout those months. But now that we have this memorized, let's just go and sing it in our community and see what happens. And again, getting back to that idea that the greatest impact of poverty is not a lack of resource, but a lack of visibility, a lack of being seen, a lack of mattering. Nothing says, look at me and we matter more than a bunch of kids in the street playing their instruments or a bunch of kids in the street singing their songs, right? And so the music might not be technically perfect at that point, right? But you have to get it out there within a system of framework, you have to get it out there because the more important goal is visibility and witness and dignity.
You are now in the Berkshires, among the many things you're doing as artistic director of the Berkshire Children's Chorus and of the Berkshire Concert Choir. Are you still using El Sistema?
Yeah, that philosophy, I mean, it's in me for good. I don't know that I'm actively or consciously at this point saying, oh, Sistema taught me this, so I'm going to try and do this, right? But that sort of philosophical bend is something that once it's in you, it would be so hard to eradicate or step away from entirely. So I imagine the answer is yes. But also I think less of like me using Sistema and more of Sistema gave me a vocabulary and a way to get at something that I, Ryan LaBoy, as a conductor, have vocationally known to be true for my whole life. Right. So I would say Sistema gives me a way to be true to what I understand. It gives me a language to speak about what is important to me. So now I would say I'm just Ryan being Ryan. And what I care about more than the beauty of the music that we make is the beauty of the community that we are weaving together. And again, I think that is what meets this moment in our lives here together in the United States, in Massachusetts, in the Berkshires, more so than the beauty of what we're singing. When I was working with communication, I came up with this pocket philosophy that has carried with me. And I would say to myself, good people make good music, and it's my job to help shape good people. And so it's if you want good cheese, you have to treat the cows right. You have to tend to the cows. You have to nurture the cows. If you want good wine, you have to nurture the grapes. If you want good music, you have to nurture the people who are making the music, right? And so then in that case, I become a steward, not just of music and like a keeper of this form, but I become a steward of the community. My responsibility is to the people that I gather with and ensuring their well-being for the very limited amount of time that I see them each week.
That's beautifully put. I understand that over the past 4 years, you've really built the children's choir in the Berkshires. And I now have heard your philosophy. What explicitly have you done it to encourage greater participation?
Within community music, now that I'm in a doctoral program, I think academically so much. So, community music is a facet of the formal study of music education. And within that, Lee Higgins does some really incredible work and philosophizing based on Derrida about the notion of welcome and hospitality in an organization and how, when in a true spirit of welcome and hospitality, when somebody comes into your organization, there is a change, or into your community, there is a change that necessarily must happen if they are truly welcome, because that means that they are welcome for all of who they are, and that community takes up the onus of nurturing who they are. And so, maybe the most powerful example of that I can give for the Berkshire Children's Chorus would be. We are now in our second year of programming in Pittsfield. So the Children's Chorus has been around for 35 years. This is our 35th anniversary season this year, which is very exciting. And for most of that time, we have rehearsed either in Great Barrington or in Sheffield, which is beautiful. But when I was hired with the Children's Chorus, and I remember being interviewed, I noticed that a number of families come from New York or come from Connecticut, in that sort of tri-state pocket of the county or corner of the county. And I just interrogated, if we are calling ourselves the Berkshire Children's Chorus, why are there these families from New York and Connecticut? What about kids from further north in the county? Sheffield and Great Barrington are pretty far south in the county. And at that point, the board didn't have a great answer for that. It actually like really lit them up that they have a really deeply critical question put in front of them that could then inform our collective job moving forward, right? And so, just looking at our name, if we are the Berkshire Children's Chorus, my commitment as your artistic director is that we are one, the Berkshire Children's Chorus. And so, we need to be a place for all of the Berkshire's children. And if we are not yet that, then we have not yet fully realized our mission. We're not necessarily failing, we're just not fully realized. And two, we are going to remember, we must remember that children is our middle name. Berkshire Children's Chorus. And everything that we do has to center around children and childhood, not as young people who will someday grow into adults, but as a unique and valuable stage of life right now. And how can we use art and music to reflect that in really beautiful ways. Children are messy, they are noisy, they are wild. You get them dressed in their uniforms, you turn around and their hair is like all amiss, right? Like that just is childhood. And so we have to, as an organization, work diligently and against some of these narratives that we have about quote unquote high art music to say yes to that maybe later in life. Although now working with adults, I don't know that I fully ascribe to that. But right here, right now, it's going to be a little bit messy. It's going to be a little bit wonky. And that is part of the beauty of childhood. In terms of an explicit example, we started programming here in Pittsfield 2 years ago, and overnight, our organization was over 40% non-white singers, just because we set up shop in Pittsfield, right? Most of those singers, those non-white singers, come from the Latine community, which is important, near and dear to my heart because I'm Puerto Rican. And so one way that we illustrate welcome and hospitality is every program that we sing now must have at least one or two pieces in Spanish language. It is no longer sufficient for us to say we're only going to sing in English, or we're going to sing in Latin, or we're going to sing in German or French or Italian, these very sort of coveted classical languages. No, we are Latine, so we must be singing in Spanish, but we know that Festival Latino happens in Great Barrington. So what sort of connections and inroads can we make with them? We know that Berkshire Immigrant Center does amazing work around naturalization. So we sang at a naturalization ceremony and as a gift welcoming new Americans to our country. And so this is one way that I didn't see that coming when I was first hired as the director of the Berkshire Children's Chorus. But as we've been evolving, we have begun to include in really meaningful and foundational ways this style of programming. We have to reflect our community.
You have been here in a short time. Do you see a community adoption of the choir?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And part of the goal of the children's chorus right now is to use our giftedness as musicians as a social highway through the Berkshires, right? So we are building an opportunity for kids to connect, not just in their immediate geography, but for kids to make new friends between programs and all over the county. Because goodness, you don't have to be in the Berkshires very long to understand that there are some like sociopolitical divides even in this county. And that's weird and strange. And just because it historically has been doesn't mean it needs to be that way forever. So how do we get these two regions or three regions of the county connected and talking with each other despite our differences? One way is through music, which culturally, humans just love. And another way is through our children. Regardless of where you come from, everybody wants to see their kids succeed. And so I think your question about are there siblings and are there networks of participation? The answer is yes. And I think part of that is because people see our kids succeeding in Berkshire Children's Chorus in really tangible and beautiful ways.
Thank you, Ryan. In our next episode, we will be speaking to Ryan about other aspects of his career in music, including the work he is doing for his doctorate on music and social prescribing. Our next guest, Daniel Anastasio, is a solo pianist and chamber music musician based in San Antonio, Texas. As artistic director of several nonprofit organizations, including Agorita, Unheard of Ensemble, and the San Antonio Chamber Music Society, his innovative programs have included collaborations with dancers, poets, museums, photographers, glass blowers, and more. He studied at Cornell University for his Bachelor of Arts in Music and Philosophy, the Juilliard School for a Master's of Music and Piano Performance, and Stony Brook University for his Doctorate of Musical Arts in Piano Performance. For the past 7 years, Daniel and his co-founders of the chamber music group Agorita have brought their superb ensemble to diverse communities across the city of San Antonio, building audiences and appreciation for the range of music they present. Welcome, Daniel Anastasio, to Living Well into the Future.
Thanks for having me.
you're enjoying an active and diverse music career that we'll talk about. But since many of our listeners reside in the Berkshires in Massachusetts, they'd be interested in your experience as a Tanglewood Music Center Fellow after college. Can you tell us about it?
So 2011, when I just had graduated from Cornell, I was a fellow at Tanglewood. And I went to Tanglewood in my high school years too. They call it BUTI, B-U-T-I,
Yes,
Boston University
of course.
Tanglewood Institute. But the fellowship program is a whole nother level of, I don't know, prestige or whatever.
And what did that program do for you?
Tanglewood was an experience of just, you were really thrown into the fire. At that year, we were doing instrumental chamber music as pianists. We were playing in the symphony as pianists. We were playing solo music, and we were playing with vocalists. And these are top vocalists from around the country who are giving master classes with famous vocal instructors like Don Upshaw and Stephanie Blythe, and also collaborative pianists on the faculty who have been doing this their entire lives. It was a shock of a learning experience in a really great way, an attitude of, hey, if you want to do this, you better learn a whole lot more. I had a mixed experience at Tanglewood where it was unbelievable. I was in a room with John Williams, for God's sake, where we were both listening to Emmanuel Axe give a masterclass in a small room of 10 people. It's so inspiring. So on the one hand, you had all this inspiring stuff. And on another, my personal feeling, just personal to my life, of wow, a little bit of imposter syndrome, a little bit of I don't think I'm ready for this in some ways. So maybe bit of a litmus test.
Well, after that, you went to Juilliard and then got your doctorate at Stony Brook. Now, among your many musical enterprises, you are artistic director of the chamber music quartet Agorita, which, in addition to performing in traditional venues, brings classical and modern music to communities across the city of San Antonio. Could you tell me something about the genesis of Agorita?
I moved away for school to the Northeast, but after my decade in the Northeast, I took a job at San Antonio College teaching full time. That's the gold standard for what you should do as a classical musician, according to someone who's, okay, I want a stable career. I want a stable life. I want a salary. I want health insurance. I'm going to try to get a college teaching job. That was always my goal, because being a freelance musician is rather unstable. So I moved back to San Antonio for that job that I was grateful to have. In January 2018, Marisa Bushman reached out to me, who I had played with in San Antonio a while back. She was a violist in the symphony. And she said, hey, we're thinking about starting a chamber group. Me, my husband Ignacio, and this girl Sarah Silver, who is a violinist in the symphony. She was, I think, associate concertmaster at the time. And I said, great. I love chamber music. Now I get to already play chamber music immediately, and why not? Let's do it. But as soon as we started meeting and trying to think about repertoire and what to do, it was clear to me that they had pretty big plans. They were thinking about alternatives to playing in the symphony, which had been struggling financially for a long time, and its future was really unstable. And they wanted to try to create something that might be like a sustaining musical experience, not just for themselves, but something in the community that we could give back and share and be a force in the San Antonio community. All of a sudden, we were having meetings that included 5 to 10 year goals and a divvying up of different roles beyond just playing. And our sort of brainstorming creative chemistry in those early meetings was pretty amazing, because we were very bold. We really reached for the stars. And I'm definitely not used to thinking in that way as an artist and as a pianist. I mean, I'm locked into my room and just playing at the piano for hours and hours. It's very narrow-minded thinking in a way. It's beautiful creative work, but it's under a microscope, right? A microscope of, oh, Brahms's world and what I need to do in this measure. Not so much, okay, 5 years from now, how can we be a sustaining chamber ensemble that is doing interesting collaborative work in the community? Our early meetings and our insistence on a strong administrative component where we're thinking ahead, we have different roles. I'm artistic director, by the way. There's an executive director, artistic director, educational director now, and CFO who's in charge of our finances. These are
All
sort of
members
the
of the group.
all members of the group. We're all the core members, and we've divvied up these essential roles. And that is really, to me, why Agorita is very successful. Can other people play their instruments as well as us or better? Yes, absolutely. It's not my proficiency at the piano that makes me really stand out, in my own opinion. Maybe someone else has another opinion, I don't know. But it's our combination of our proficiency at our instruments and our desire and our passion for music, but also our ability to zoom out, get outside of ourselves, not take ourselves too seriously, and look at the bigger picture, get things done in an operative way where we're not stepping on each other's toes. We respect each other's boundaries. We respect each other's musical opinions, but also our logistical opinions. And we're working toward the betterment of the group as a whole. So we have a work chemistry that is very well oiled. And I think if I were to give any advice for ensembles starting up, it's not always just a good idea for pure artists to come together and love music. You need to handle the other stuff really well, that other maybe not so interesting stuff to an artist, like budgeting and responding to emails and following up, especially with supporters and understanding what it takes to run a nonprofit, all these things. That ultimately is as important or more important to creating a successful organization. So we're lucky that we've been able to do that, just the four of us. We now have an executive assistant as well who helps us, but our synergy there is really profound and important.
You're bringing the music to the community and to having a traveling stage. I mean, how did that come about? Where do you go?
During COVID, we had to get creative because even in Texas, things were a little bit shut down. And with the mask wearing, live events were uncertain how that would look for the foreseeable future. Our job as performers is totally based on those live events, obviously. Other live performers who are not musicians suffered from this too, including comics and other things where it's okay, what are we going to do? Am I going to have a comedy show on Zoom? That doesn't really work. Same with us, where okay, live streaming was a thing for a minute, but one of the ideas that we came up with, I stole from a festival that I went to called Yellow Barn Music Festival in Vermont, in Putney, Vermont. A amazing festival where you go as fellows. It's a bit like Tanglewood, but it's all chamber music, or mostly chamber music, and very innovative programming and very interesting stuff going on, run by Seth Knopp. And they had a Yellow Barn Music Hall, which was a truck that they formatted so that the back of the truck was a stage. And I had played on it a few times, but they would drive this truck around town and to cities like New York, spread the gospel of chamber music and of Yellow Barn. And at a time like COVID, all of a sudden, this made perfect sense to me to do, especially during COVID, because playing outdoors was totally fine. Being able to bring this music outside in different areas of San Antonio in a safe way suddenly felt like a really compelling idea. Not to mention that most of San Antonio, anyway, doesn't get to hear classical music, especially the South and the West sides of San Antonio, where it's really just not brought to them. You'd have to go downtown or you have to go to the North side to experience some stuff. Just checked a lot of boxes for us in terms of what we wanted to do in the community. It would require a lot of money because we would need instruments like carbon fiber instruments that you can play outdoors in a safe way and wouldn't harm the instruments. Our violinist, for example, has an instrument that's hundreds of thousands of dollars. So these are valuable instruments that you can't play outdoors, especially in 100-degree heat, but you can play carbon fiber instruments. Luckily, we had a couple friends who were running this thing, Humble House Foods, where they had a food truck, but they weren't using it anymore. And they very generously donated it to us. So we outfitted this food truck to become our Humble Hall, which is our outdoor concert stage.
So does it open up?
No, we ended up, we explored different options in terms of outfitting it to open up into a stage. And it just got so complicated and so expensive that we decided that it was essentially a transport vehicle, but inside of it is a portable stage that we bring out and put next to the truck. That's worked out better anyway, because certain spaces are just, it's just better if we can just have the stage and we have the truck on the side. It's more malleable this way. So, yeah, we bring that, our Humble Haul truck, to t all 10 districts of San Antonio, and we amplify and we play music that we love, that we think that people will love, and we talk to the audience.
I've had people say to me, "You listen to classical music. We don't listen to that. That's not our thing." Is that a barrier that you and the other musicians in your group cross by talking to the audience about the music before the performance and sometimes before each piece?
I think that what I've learned about San Antonio, and I don't know if it's true everywhere, but people are incredibly open. I don't think anyone is coming in with prejudice here about classical music. They're not coming in with preformed ideas of how to listen or what they're listening to. For the most part, everyone just thinks it's awesome. And our talking to the audience, even just a little bit, goes a long way in making them feel like, oh, yeah, this is just music. Like, this, it's a beautiful day. I'm listening to some, what was it again? Bach? Okay, great. And the programming that I do is very intentional. So I'll mix old music with new music. You might hear a movement of a Beethoven string trio, something from Piazzolla's The Four Seasons, like a tango. And then you might hear a minimalist work by John Adams. It's really all over the map, but everything is intentionally woven into a theme, so that you're not so much concerned with the specific style or context or character of the music. And oh, if you don't get it, then you don't get it. If you don't understand how a two-note slur works in Haydn, then you're really not getting the meaning of the sighing affect that he's trying to go for. Rather than scolding the audience about specifics of those stylistic characteristics, it's more about taking them on a musical, emotional journey. An emotional narrative that they can, that anyone can understand. I'm trying to let the audience see the whole picture rather than get lost in the weeds of what they may or may not know about details. I'm thinking about the audience experience literally at every minute. And because of that, we don't play very long pieces. We play movements of stuff. Oftentimes, it's a bit of a tasting menu of different things so that people get a sense of variety. I'm very sensitive to the fact that right now, people's attentions are, there's a war on our attention right now, for sure. That is a struggle even for me to fight, even as I'm very aware of it. But it's, that's a factor where I'm not about to force someone to listen to 30 minutes of Beethoven, because that I know what that can do. But at the same time, if given the right context and the right speaking and things like that, maybe it is possible, and it's for that to be very effective. But that takes some legwork. So when we're going out in the community and playing in the different districts and just doing a Sunday afternoon concert, we want it to be light. We want it to be fun. We want to be talking to the audience. And I will say that speaking to the audience has allowed for our own personalities to come out for them in a way that is very valuable. I think that people come to our shows now to see us. In other words, they trust what we're going to program at this point and that we're going to put on a good show. And they just want to see what we come up with, and they want to feel connected to us personally.
What gives the power of the music to the audience and generations that don't listen to classical music that much? How do you make that connection?
Okay, here's where I think some people, some classical musicians may disagree with me, but I don't think the music speaks for itself. So I don't think that your average audience member in the 21st century will feel that, what I just explained. I really don't think they will. And I don't think that's their fault. I don't think it's the music's fault either. I think that a big part of why I feel the way I do so passionately about music is the fact that I've been lucky enough to study it since I was very young and gotten teachers who have helped me reveal these things in the music. Without that, I don't think I would necessarily feel as strongly as the way I do. I think honestly, the key is to talk about it. I think the key is to do exactly what I'm doing right now in this podcast, which is start to explain why and how I feel the music as someone who does it all the time, give it some context, some musical stylistic context, especially, but maybe also some historical context if that's needed to the audience in order to help give some entry points. Everyone absolutely has the capacity to feel just as strongly as I do about any of this stuff. And it doesn't take years of conservatory training, that's for sure. What it does take, I think, is for the performer to give some insight into how and why they feel the way that they do, where in the music there are more powerful moments, and just point the lens of attention towards certain moments in the music. Otherwise, I think the average listener just simply doesn't exactly know how or what to listen to. And other than they're always going to feel like, wow, this is beautiful music. Oh, I feel so relaxed when I listen to Schubert. Isn't it so beautiful? Just the harmonies and this and that. And like that, maybe that's enough. That's enough for a lot of people to just feel that, to feel whenever I listen to Schubert, I just get relaxed and I do it before bed and I go to sleep and I just feel calm. And I think that's beautiful. It's like this music is like a great novel. Schubert's A major sonata, for example, is like a great novel. And when I'm practicing it, I'm reading a great novel full of characters, full of conflict and controversy, ultimately acceptance and love. And I would love to share those deeper connections to the music because when I play, I want to feel like I'm reviving Schubert's soul in some way. I think this music is like, it's like he's left a little diary or a black box of something deep in his soul. And I'm going to try to excavate that and share that. But in order to share that really with a 21st century audience, I don't think we should take for granted that this music's really old. It's really old. It was written in a totally different culture and time. Not everyone also connects with Western European art music, all of those things. It's a specific kind of context. And I think we need to talk to audiences, which is very intimidating for people, not least because it's hard to articulate abstract concepts like music. Very hard. And I'm grateful for my philosophy degree. It's another reason I encourage a liberal arts education. I'm grateful for that philosophy degree because it helped me to be able to express myself about abstract concepts in a very clear way. And it's not only that, but I think that has certainly helped me.
Is there a universal in music? How does music bind people to people and people to communities? That is not your job as a musician, but you must think about it. So could you tell me how you think about it?
Yeah, this is such a tricky question, and I really have been dancing around it because the truth is, there is a universality, I think, even in something like what I mentioned before about Schubert, where Schubert's soul, what he's expressing deep down, I think can reach absolutely anyone. But I think that the way that it's presented in a classical context, largely in the 20th century, but also in the 21st century, the way it's been presented is anachronistic to it. So, what I mean is, there is a disconnect where you're getting this incredible music, very profound, beautiful stuff that can touch anyone. And that is, let's say, like the five star or the three Michelin star meal that is being put onto a paper plate and then expected to be enjoyed. And to me, that paper plate is playing in a beautiful concert hall with absolutely no talking. And everybody is just straitjacketed. They can't clap, they can't holler, they can't react. There's no sense of ease. That to me is the disconnect where I think this music, again, is not at fault. I'm trying to convince people that anyone can profoundly connect to any of this music when the context is right. So it's our jobs as 21st century performers to understand not just the context of Schubert and how to bring out Schubert the way that maybe Schubert intended, but also the context of the listener who is doing half the job to bring Schubert's expression and connectivity to light. So when there's too much that's only put on this traditional classical music for the traditional classical music's sake, and not enough consideration is given to our own environment and context as 21st century listeners, that connection is broken. And likewise, if we cheapen Schubert's message by focusing too much on what someone with their iPhone in the 21st century might consider to be fun and interesting, and not something that Schubert might find incredibly beautiful, then the connection is affected there too. So it's that middle ground where you're not only creating an incredible meal, but the atmosphere and the environment and the community, everything is working together to enhance your experience of that meal. And that could be an incredible taco, like side of a truck, no frills. And that is the appropriate atmosphere. That's the appropriate context for that meal. Whereas maybe in a French bistro style, you need everything to be just right in order to. It's everything. It's everything. It's lighting. It's talking to the audience. It's considering the audience experience every minute from transitions to the beginning, the pre-concert to post-concert. It's create an experience for someone so that they're at least have a chance to deeply connect with this stuff. As if at the beginning of a performance, you almost are hitting a meditation bell to say, hey, it's time to listen to something that I know is going to move you, and I'm going to show you how and why.
We've been listening to this music for now centuries. And yet, what I hear you saying is that there's not a universality inherent in the music itself, that it needs context. You look at a painting, and it's how you receive it as a person. You don't need the artist to explain what their intent was. It might be very different from what you perceive. But what I hear you saying here is that the music needs a context for anybody.
I think that at its deepest levels, I think that it helps. That's what I'm saying. If you take someone from one culture and you stick them in a completely different culture, you can't expect them to right away taste the best version of that culture's food and for them to say, oh my God, this is the best version of this culture's food, apparently. Or that culture can't be frustrated at you for not understanding it. It needs to be an assimilative kind of process where you provide entry points. It doesn't take away the fact that this stuff is universal. It's just that it's a bit like, okay, do you want me to give you 3D glasses to see this 3D movie? Because I can if you want. It doesn't take away any of the power of the 3D movie itself, the fact that I'm not wearing 3D glasses. Just because it's blurry to me doesn't mean that the movie is not universally powerful. It's just that there's the me also here. I'm a factor. And if I'm to receive that universally powerful stuff, I might need tools. Can somebody please help me by providing me with those 3D glasses? And I want to be someone who gives the audience those 3D glasses.
And you do. Thank you, Daniel, for that explanation of how and why you bring your passion for the music to your audiences to ignite theirs. We'd love to hear from listeners how, if, and when they are transported by music, classical or otherwise. Mark your calendars so you don't forget our next episode when we turn our attention to the power of music to heal with Dr. Penny Roberts and Ryan LaBoy and Daniel Anastasio, who you heard today. Our thanks from me, Julie B. Adler, to Berkshire Ali, WTBR-FM 89.7 Pittsfield, and the Berkshire Eagle for their support.
We hope that you enjoyed this episode and found food for thought and further discussion with family, friends, and the wider community. If you want to repeat this episode and hear others, you can find them at Living Well Into the Future on 89.7 WTBR Pittsfield, 88.1 WSBR Lee, WTBRFM.com, Apple Podcasts, and other streaming services. Subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. We invite you to contribute to Living Well Into the Future with your comments and suggestions for topics and even guests. Write to us at lwitf22@gmail.com or through our website at livingwellintothefuture.com, where you can find show notes, past episodes, and information about our guests.
This podcast is produced by Julie Kopenheffer. Our music is written and performed by Michael Kopenheffer. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and not of WTBR-FM, Berkshire Ali, or the Berkshire Eagle, or the LWITF production team.